Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs, and Mike Murphy.
I believe when you use your power, the power to vote, you're going to change the course of this country for generations to come at home and abroad. This election is the most important one you've ever voted in, whether it's your first or 10th. Ladies and gentlemen, the heart and soul of this country is at stake right here in Florida. It's up to you. You hold the key. If Florida goes blue, it's over. It's over. Look. The press has heard me say this a long time. Wall Street and CEOs didn't build this country. People standing out here in their automobiles, you're the ones that built this country. The middle class built this country, and unions built the middle class. You're the ones who are going to save the country now that you build it. In these final days, keep that sense of empowerment with you, that sense of optimism, of what we can do, what we will overcome. I've never been more optimistic about America or the American people than I am today. And on November the 3rd, we're going to unite this country and show the world who we really are.
Riots are having in France. The people are tired. They can't do it anymore. They're losing their businesses. They're losing their jobs. They go back and the business is closed for 9 months. We can't do it anymore. They can't do it. We know the disease. We social distance. We do all of the things that you have to do. If you get close, wear a mask. Always controversial. It's not controversial to me. You get close, you wear a mask. Social distance, social distance. You know the bottom line, though? You're going to get better. You're going to get better. If I can get better, anybody can get better. And I got better fast. They were so happy. They couldn't believe it. That was probably the happiest day that they've had in years.
Dueling sound from this afternoon's Florida rallies with both former Vice President Joe Biden and current President Donald Trump. And as we record this on Thursday, at least 80 million Americans have already cast their vote. Have you voted?
I have, actually. Yeah, I've voted. I've been sweating out the counting of my ballot, which I sent in remotely. It apparently is in the custody of the authorities right now, so I feel good about it. But 80 million. It's remarkable. Hey, you see who I see here too?
I see his hat first, and now yeah. I can make him out. You the one and
the
only.
First. Mac the Knife, Mark McKinnon, my old buddy.
How are
good
you?
Good to see you, brother. How's the road?
Private first class hackaroo checking in for duty.
How's the road?
I just was in Texas yesterday, so I looked for any excuse to go back to Austin, so that was great. And there was a ton going on down there. And you know, I did a piece a week before about all these lawsuits going back and forth about the mail ballots and the drive throughs and all that. And it drives me insane that the Republican Party has been so successful in communicating a message that we want fewer people to vote.
It doesn't seem to have impacted on people down there. You had 8 million people have voted
just
already.
The reverse, guys. I think just the reverse. I think Donald Trump, by waving this rigged flag and election fraud, it turned out to be the greatest GOTV mechanism for Democrats in history.
Yeah, so as we record this, we're sitting at in Texas, 8.5 million votes essentially cast already, 94% of the 2016 turnout, which
overall, not just the early turnout,
right, 26% of the overall turnout in 2016,
97% of the people in Austin registered to vote, 97. Yeah.
let's maybe we'll start there, Mark. I mean, it is. Look,
by the way, just before you ask him, Robert, you think that's impressive? 107% of the people who registered to vote in Chicago. So I had to do it for Murphy because he's Murphy, not here. I had to Murphy, do it for Murphy.
I was going to say Murphy usually makes that joke, and Axe always wants to get ahead of it to sort of contain its impact. No, but Mark, you know, look, I in 2002, I spent some time in Austin because we were going to turn Texas blue. That was sadly 18 years ago, and we're still waiting for that particular
nice job there, Gibbs.
Yeah, particular hue to come forward. What do you think makes potentially 2020 different? Could this be the year that Texas goes blue in a presidential?
Well, I've heard that refrain so many times, Gibbs, including 2002, that I'm
you should have told me it wasn't going to happen.
Well,
it's a lot different in Texas now, though, isn't it?
I worked for Ann Richards in 1990, and that election, that there are 28 statewide office holders in Texas, and that year, all 28 were Democrats. 8 years later, after George Bush came to town and just said, I'm a conservative alternative with a compassionate conservative message, and tons of people, including me, said, that's what I want to be. That's what I want to do. That's who I'm for. And then all 28 statewide offices have been Republican ever since. So, it is a very conservative state, as you know, and which isn't all about ideology. It's about kind of lifestyle and a lot of other things. But I'll tell you what, the notion that Biden's polling even within the margins is kind of stunning. And it testifies that, something really is. I mean, we know there's a demographic trend going there, but maybe this is just going to speed it all up. And maybe it's a combination of demographic tide and incumbent problem. I'll tell you one thing I was going to ask you guys. If I had asked you back in February, what are the four things you would love to have happen for Democrats and what would be the worst possible case for Donald Trump? And you'd say, well, probably four things. One, we elect a centrist, safe, acceptable nominee like Joe Biden. Two, there'd be a global pandemic. Three, the president of the United States would get that virus. And four, in the last week of the campaign, he'd be going around to swing states holding rallies where the headline of the news in all those places is the virus is spiking, holding rallies where people, a lot of them are not wearing masks and not social distancing. I mean, it's crazy that this thing would even be close.
I have to confess, I didn't think about the pandemic thing. McKinnon, you must think we're awfully ghoulish to think that we would have dreamed that scenario up.
But well, Dick Morris thought of that one, actually.
I'm sure he did. On Texas, I mean, what is astonishing is it is the prototype of what's happening in suburban America. Mm-hmm. That's what's driving this. That's what has it in turbocharge. Even if Biden doesn't win Texas, and I think it's a long shot for him to win Texas, these congressional districts that were reliable Republican congressional districts, a bunch more are going to fall.
Well, not only that, but my colleagues down there are pretty confident that the Texas House is Democrat.
They need 9 seats.
Yeah.
That could turn. So, down there, Gibbs, it was a different state.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And look, I picked a bad year, but that was also when George W. Bush's approval rating was the same as a wide receiver's jersey number in the mid to upper 80s. And it just wasn't altogether a good thing to do. But Mark, did you ever, when you watched all those offices flip, you probably thought it'd be a long time, if ever, before the Texas House went Democratic.
I wasn't sure that I'd live to see it, honestly. Like I said, it's just a very conservative place. And, I think it testifies to the extent. It reminds me of what it was like in the late 80s, early 90s, when things flipped the other way, which is you had a kind of a Democratic Party that had ossified, and taken things for granted. And, you were either kind of a liberal, progressive Democrat or conservative Democrat. There really wasn't much of a Republican Party. And then Bush came to town with a compelling message. But now that they've been in office, and held power for almost 30 years, I think the same thing is happening, that people are looking at the Republican Party in Texas going, really? What have you done for me lately? And plus, it is a changing place. Like, I was talking to some British TV earlier today, and they were talking about the debate and Biden's comments about transitioning from oil, and isn't that going to hurt him in Texas? Actually, Ted Cruz said, hey, we're not all wildcatters in Houston anymore. It's a lot of, it's a lot of Asian immigrants and tech people. And so, Biden may be talking to a whole new audience in Texas.
You've got your Stetson on, so just to certify your genuine authenticity as someone who could comment on Texas. What are your buddies saying on the Republican side down there? How much of a concern is there, not just about the presidential race, but about all these other things? Are they worried about Cornyn at all?
You know, they think he's going to be okay. I just talked to MJ Hager yesterday, who's really impressive. You know, she's her story is just stunning. Yeah. You know, her veteran story is just, I mean, she and Amelia Earhart and, you know, like two or three others have won the kind of medals that she's won for her valor in combat.
Well, I hope it ends up better for her than Amelia Earhart, but anyway.
But it's pretty easy to get lost in Texas.
Yeah.
But, you know, Cornyn's from central casting. I mean, he's, you know, he looks like a senator. He sounds like a senator. And, he, you know, this is, he's not Ted Cruz. I mean, there are actually other members of the Senate that like him. So I think Biden's a stretch. The Senate, I think, would be, you know, even tougher. And plus, you know, as she said to me herself, she said, I think Texas is going to go purple before it goes blue. And I think mm-hmm. she's right about that. And the other thing that they changed in the laws now is they don't have straight ticket voting, which could actually help Republicans if you think about it, because you could have people saying, I'm not so sure about Trump anymore, but then kind of return to form down ballot.
And, you know, I think even if you don't see this happen in Texas, I do think you're going to watch that suburbanization of the vote here happen. I know, Axe, you've talked about this before. I have too. It would not surprise me in the least to watch Georgia, a state that was closer in 2016 than either Ohio or Iowa, and demographically a lot better than either of those two states. It wouldn't shock me at all to watch Georgia go blue. There's a little bit better history or more recent history of it being such in a presidential race in 1992. But I think it will be interesting to watch in this last few days and then afterwards when the dust settles, how much of this demographic change has really brought about and hastened some of this electoral change.
Well, look, think about the states we're talking about, Georgia, Arizona, where
we're there tomorrow,
which I think is very much in play in this election. The fact that we're even talking about Texas. I mean, Trump carried it by 9 points last time, and everybody thought that was a stunningly close margin.
Right.
And now we're talking about an even closer race, and we're talking about, I mean, this volcanic sort of change in suburban areas in Texas. And it does sort of, you can glimpse the future. I mean, Mark, smart Republicans have to look at this and say, we've got a problem here because the tide is not flowing our way. And if we keep doing what we're doing, this thing's going to close on us.
Well, but part of the problem for Donald Trump and the Republican Party is that he ignored a lot of the work that a lot of people did right after 2012. You guys probably remember that there was that
autopsy.
That was,
yeah.
Which had, you know, was really smart and really, you know, put forward a plan for the future about how to expand the map and
to minorities, to women.
Yes, of course. And instead, you know, Donald Trump flipped the script and decided he'd try and get more people from a diminishing demographic, and he's trying to double down on that again. And so it's gonna be a ton of work for Republicans to. I mean, it's kind of like what Pete Wilson did in California. It's just gonna take a long time to fix
with Proposition 187. There, the anti-immigration thing. There. Well, you know, you talk about this is one of the conundrums for Trump right now. You talk about the constituency that he's depending on, and it's a shrunken constituency. Part of it involves older voters. And, you know, one thing this virus has done, because he's been so casual about discarding the old folks and saying sayonara, there is a real reaction to that. And you can see it in the numbers. I mean, he won seniors by 8-9 points last time. He is trailing. Now in many, overall, he's trailing. He's trailing in many places. Obviously a problem in a state like Florida, which is why they're both down at the Villages, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck in the exit poll in Florida in 2016. Donald Trump's won seniors by 17 points. In the latest NBC News Marist poll, Biden leads that same group by 7. And so, you know, there are a lot of demographic groups that I think we'll spend time poring over post this election. But it undoubtedly, whether it acts, as you said, Arizona, Florida, true, and certainly in Pennsylvania, and all over the Sun Belt, as these people have, seniors have come to retire in places that are a lot warmer. This is the demographic that is making so many of these places so much more competitive, and to some degree might well be the gap that puts Joe Biden over the top on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, Biden was always, you know, one of his strengths in the primaries. And, you know, that was a kind of a shaky enterprise for a while. But the thing that kept him in it were seniors, obviously, ultimately, African-Americans. And that was an older vote. But seniors, and he's done well with seniors. So the combination of Trump and the virus and his handling of the virus and Biden's natural, and maybe it's, you know, let's face it. I mean, Biden is an older guy, but on this issue of the other category, though, is race. Now, I was stunned. The CNN had a poll yesterday, and it may be too optimistic from a Biden standpoint, 12 points. But among whites, you guys, 50-48 Trump. 50-48. Now, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 20 points among white voters. No one's gotten in the upper 40s, I think. Bill Clinton may have in one election gotten against a Republican. That is a stunning number. And, you know, that is a, that may be a, it, I guess the question is how much can Democrats can, you know, count on that in the future? You talk about challenges for the Republican Party, challenges for the Democratic Party is in the transition, in the metamorphosis of the country. Demographically, there's going to be this period where, you know, you're going to have to get your share of white voters. The reason Biden was a strong general election candidate is he's got a reach into, he's comfortable for moderate suburban voters. He has a cultural link to non-college white voters that will hold Trump's margin down. These non-college white women are, you know, Trump may beat him only by senior single digits with these voters. He beat Hillary Clinton by 27 points with those white non-college women. So Biden has, you know, a particular appeal. I just want to be even-handed about this. Democrats have things to think about too, in you know, at least in the near term, about not doing what they did in 2016 and writing off that constituency. So Biden was uniquely suited for this moment.
Yeah, and I've been thinking in the last couple of days about just how much weight of hope, anticipation. Just think of all that's in that backpack on that old broken back of Joe Biden in the Democratic Party. What he has carried up this mountain like Sisyphus, you know, is really remarkable. To think that, you know, as damaged a psyche as the Democratic Party has been since 2016, that they just everything, so much is loaded on Joe Biden, and he may do it. He looks like he's going to do it.
Yeah, Sisyphus actually, for Sisyphus rolled that boulder up the hill, and then it fell down again. So he'd probably like not to be Sisyphus.
Ulysses, but, like Ulysses.
Yeah, we're hoping that Tuesday gets here before the boulder.
I can't stress how much this virus has, you know, played to his advantage in this election in so many different ways. But people are looking for solidity, for comfort, for empathy, for connection, for calm.
He's the one candidate that you can imagine where something happens that drives him to his basement becomes an advantage.
Yeah. Right. Well, that became an advantage. That will be picked over. You know, the thing is, and we'll see what happens Tuesday, because we ought to allow somewhere in this conversation for the fact that the unexpected could happen, just in case the unexpected happens.
I was going to bring that up.
But the
conventional wisdom is often wrong, fellas.
Yes, yeah, sure. Everybody's got PTSD. I know that. But if Biden wins, you're never as smart as you look when you win, and you're never as dumb as you look when you lose. He is the right man in the right place at the right time. And this basement strategy, so-called, wasn't a strategy. It was a necessity. You know, they were worried about him being exposed to the virus as an older person. What made it work was Donald Trump, because when he left the stage, Trump filled it completely, and he filled it to his own disadvantage. Those 6 weeks of those press conferences where he just killed himself. And so that made it all pay off. That's not to say, and Gibbs, I got to get this one thing in here. Our old buddy, Jen O'Malley Dillon, who took over the Biden campaign after the primary. The Biden campaign was a rickety ship at the time. They hadn't raised any money. Primary was kind of a shambling affair. And she has, this has been a really well-conceived and well-run campaign. And she's done it with, you know, the inability to get together. She had to do it all remotely. She didn't really have a relationship with the candidate. The candidate has a very insular team. And it is extraordinary, really, what they've accomplished. And whatever happens on Tuesday, she has done an extraordinary job.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think she's whipped that place into shape. I think we all heard, you know, we all understood sort of what that campaign was like, certainly in the tougher days of the primary, but even as it emerged. Look, I'm also struck, you know, by, you know, some of the things we used to talk about acts with Obama, and that is, you know, you don't pick the moment picks you. And I really do think that, to your point and Mark as well, I mean, this has been a moment that Biden fits really, really well into. And you couldn't have thought a year ago, here are the things you need to do because this is going to happen. And that's the interesting thing about particularly presidential politics is there's a lot of candidates on paper a year ago or 18 months ago that look quote unquote unbeatable. There's a whole list of presidents that never were, that shaved every morning and looked in the mirror and saw the next president. And I think he's really met that moment. Also, you know, and I've said this a few times, he deserves an enormous amount of credit. His closing argument was actually his opening argument. And that's really hard to do in modern politics because not only do you change and your polling says you need to change, but the events change. And that requires you to shift this.
Well,
and
you for guys him, know this. You guys
for him
that.
To do that is just kudos to him and to his team for understanding what the moment required.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. McKinnon, you know this because you had to keep this train on the track. You know what it's like to keep a message on track in a campaign. You're going 200 miles an hour. There are a million opportunities to spin off the track.
And there's so much pressure to go off the track from constituencies and people who think you're fucking up and you're down in the polls. And it's like, oh, you got to change strategy. You got to change message.
Right.
County chairman on line two, McKinnon.
And we said in 2004, you know, we said that, listen, this may not be the perfect strategy, but we're going to stick with it. And, you know, a flawed strategy perfectly executed is better than a strategy that changes every week to the moment.
Which is one of Trump's problems, because everything is kind of ad-libbed and impulsive. And, you know, they could still win. I'm going to keep saying it. But had he been on a consistent message, and probably the best one for him would have been to attack, you know, a more traditional Republican message around taxes. And
well, also, I mean, he had pretty good message in the last debate where he was really framing Biden as, well, you had your chance and you didn't do it, you know?
Yeah, that's another element.
I thought that was pretty effective, and Biden didn't come back very well on it.
But he's indulging himself out there with these rallies.
Well, and the clip you played today was all about the virus. That's the last thing he wants to be talking about or should be talking about.
Yeah. I mean, well, what about these rallies, man? Traditionally, Robert, you know, we did rally after rally after rally. It connotes excitement. It connotes energy. But in this environment, is it a mixed bag?
It's worse than a mixed bag, David. I saw some polling on this today, And it is much more than a majority of voters, like in the 60, 70% range of people who think that it's a bad idea.
It's irresponsible.
You know, yeah. And I was trying to say, you know, who's the undecided voter that looks that, you know, either says, oh, I've never been to a rally, I'm going to go to one now. Or sees it and says, oh, yeah, I think I'm going to vote for Donald Trump now because of a rally.
Yeah. Well, look, I think they may make make people like us all feel better that last week when there's at least something to do and somewhere to go. And look, I think probably like all Democrats and maybe even Republicans, if they were in this place, I mean, you do get worried that there is a field component to a good rally, right? You're gathering information.
Yes.
You're giving out sort of like, hey, great, you want to knock on doors?
Gives the troops something to do. Yeah,
absolutely. And so there is that that natural kind of consternation that, with that not happening, and with it happening on the other side, there's that nervousness of, gosh, shouldn't we be doing what they're doing?
And there's a lot of hand wringing about it going on right now.
Yeah, and there is limited door knocking, I know, going on in places like North Carolina and Pennsylvania, which is good. On the Democratic side, it's done, you know, in a very coordinated way. But, you know, we all wished we had politics that was normal. We all wish we had a lot that was more normal. But I think the Biden campaign has figured out how to do this as well as they could in a world that's nobody could have prepared for.
I mean, I agree with this. I think the biggest thing is, yeah, they're setting a good example, and that's good from a message standpoint. I also think you want to keep the freaking candidate healthy. You know what I mean? You don't
never
want
a bad
to
thing.
Take the risks that Trump took. To me, the biggest threat to Biden between now and election day might be that intervening health event. You know,
absolutely.
So I think that has to be part of their consideration as well.
And it should be. You don't want to literally kill the candidate.
That's always bad. You know, whenever we have a strategy meetings, we always start with that. Let's not kill the candidate.
You know, but it going back to one point that was made, I mean, I think one of the things, when you listed off those four things, McKinnon, of you know, could you have imagined in February, Axe said this. I mean, I would not have thought the Trump campaign would run as undisciplined a campaign. There still isn't a cohesive, coherent, consistent negative Biden frame that you hear each and every day. And I think part of that is Trump looks at rallies and Trump looks at press conferences as a moment of entertaining those that have come to watch. But I'm really shocked that they never took any natural advantage of being the candidate most likely to rebuild the economy. They're just a dozens and dozens of opportunities, even in the face of an unpredictable global pandemic, that they just never seized on to run as strong a campaign as I would have thought they could.
Because these things expose who you are. And Donald Trump approached the virus as he's approached everything else in his life, not as a problem to solve, but as a thing to spin. And he thought that he could spin it. And he's still trying to spin it 6-5 days before this election.
We're
with
the
numbers
the
going through the roof.
Coming around the corner.
Yeah, we're coming around the
right
corner.
Right off the cliff.
And except there's a brick wall right in front of you. So be a little careful there. No, I mean, you know, but I will say this. We say, who could have predicted that Biden would be this kind of a challenging candidate for Trump? I'll tell you who predicted it. Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump bought himself an impeachment trying to stop Biden.
There's a reason he went to Ukraine for dirt.
Of course. And the reason is that he saw Biden as this culturally inconvenient candidate who would be difficult for him to demonize and paint as a left-wing radical. And he thought he wasn't going to be a good foil for his politics. And it turns out he, in addition to the strengths that Biden has in the midst of a pandemic, in addition to how poorly Trump has handled the pandemic, there's also that, you know, and Trump recognized it, and he recognized it probably before a lot of people.
I don't disagree. I still think you could have figured out a frame, you know. I still think you could have figured out okay, so he's not an AOC liberal. You could have said, well, but he still is. You know, if you look back at him, tax and spend. If you look back at, you know.
100%, Robert. I'm not suggesting otherwise. I'm just saying that there were strengths. A lot of the reasons Joe Biden had a problem in the primary make him a good general election
absolutely
candidate.
Absolutely. But
so what about this he could lose thing? I mean, we should really address it because
right. I was going to, you know, Mark, you're in all these states. You're in Arizona. You're in Texas. You're in, you know, he's got to run all these. You got to win all of them. But where do you see in the places that you've either been or you look at, where does Trump gain some traction and make this at least a week long affair?
Well, let me start the other way around, which is, you know, I remember very clearly, because I give her a hard time about it all the time, being with Jen Palmieri and Hillary Clinton, like in Arizona right before the election.
Yeah, which was.
And I remember thinking, why are we in Arizona? You know, and they were trying to run up the score and, you know, and neglecting Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And so.
Don't even get me started.
but I do think that Arizona is really in play this time. And I think, I think that it's a. And I think it needs to be in play for Biden because I think he needs that insurance because I still worry like hell about Pennsylvania. And that's where I think Trump could still win. I think people are pinning a lot of hopes on Democrats winning that. And I still think he's got a shot there. And if he wins Pennsylvania, then they got to have a backup plan. And I think Arizona is part of that backup plan.
Yeah, only part because Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes and Arizona's 11. I agree of the three. Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the one that creates the most anxiety. But, you know, I'm looking at polling from there constantly. And, you know, he's running well ahead of where Hillary was throughout the state. I mean, whatever the baseline was, Biden seems to be running 6 to 12 points ahead of her. The other thing was there was this poll the other day. I may have talked about it earlier in the week, but it was reaffirmed in some of the, I think the New York Times polling from, or the Post polling from Michigan and Wisconsin. But the people who voted third party last time who really flipped the thing to Trump, they're 2-1 for Biden. People who didn't vote last time, you know, 2-1 for Biden. So these pockets of vote that really sunk Hillary Clinton are consolidating in much larger numbers around Biden. But, you know, there are a lot of unknowns here, you know, about who shows up on Tuesday. And
you know, I talked to Karl Rove about, you know, some of the registration numbers of the Republicans. And in some key places like Florida and Pennsylvania, they've had some pretty good registration efforts.
Although the numbers are not, first of all, there are conversions of people from Democrat to Republican that are included in there. And those are people who voted for Trump and are just now kind of conforming their party registration to that. And then the next issue, like in Florida, is there have been a lot of registrations, no party affiliation. And there is some reason to believe that those numbers are skew more Democrat in their leanings than Republican. So, I mean, I don't want to alibi. The Democrats did a shit job.
No, I just say you ask how he could win. It could be these new registrations. It could be, you know, that they actually do have, you know, great Cuban support in Miami and end up winning Florida.
Yes.
They actually do turn out a bunch of non-college white voters that didn't vote last time. You know, it's skeptical to see how they can get much more of those, but maybe they do.
Well, there are a lot of them who are sitting on the sidelines. But in Florida, I think that, you know, the truth is the Trump campaign, the one thing that they have done well in the last 4 years is they have done this sort of microscopic, sort of micro-targeting effort with segments of the black community, young black men, with the Hispanic community. And Biden is running a little bit behind. And in Florida, you have the complication of the Cuban community that Trump has worked very, very hard. And so there is some nervousness about in Florida about whether, you know, that diversity, you know, actually hurts in, you know, in ways that are unexpected, that Biden won't hit his mark and he can't make it up somewhere else. That is the scenario. That's actually how Scott and the governor won DeSantis, in 2000.
Well, and ironically, you know, we could sit here after Election Day and see that Biden actually did better with whites, but lost it in, as you guys have talked about, African Americans and Hispanic voters in a way that flips. But, you know, to build off of that original question, Mark, if Trump holds Florida and wins again, and also holds Pennsylvania, you're on to some turf that is a bit more Republican, because then you're holding you got to hold North Carolina, you got to hold Arizona, you obviously have to hold the Iowas and the Ohios, but all of a sudden that becomes a much, much closer ball game for I'm going to call it election week, because that's going to transpire over into days and days, not just hours and hours.
Yeah, that would suck.
You know, I talked to Ben Ginsburg, who you guys know is a long-time
Republican lawyer,
election law guy. Yeah, and I kind of went through all these scenarios with him, and we talked about, you know, he painted different scenarios, and Pennsylvania is obviously the problematic one, because we don't need to go through all the litigation that's happened there. But the reality is that, and the good thing actually is that Amy Coney Barrett recused herself this week from a couple of key decisions that are going to allow them to count the votes in Pennsylvania after the election, which they should.
Yeah, but it could set up litigation after the election. They're going to segregate those ballots.
Well, and the Supreme Court said that.
Yeah.
Right. So that's if Pennsylvania becomes the key and we don't know, that gets us into a
McKinnon
much longer.
He's having 2,000 flashbacks here.
Yeah. Well,
the thing that this is so obvious to you guys and most of the listeners as well, but I said, Ben, what's the flip side of that scenario? He said, Florida early for Biden and it's over.
Yeah, that is it. I mean, I think whether we have a long twilight struggle here and legal battle, or whether we have an early night, relatively early night, depends on Florida. How you feel about that, McKinnon? It's Florida again.
Florida, Florida, Florida. Tim Russert.
But I
think it's possible. And for just the sake of the sanity of everybody, it'd be great to have a clear and decisive victory. And Florida would do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, you know, I just think the whole change in the way we're voting has made it a little bit more difficult to divine what's going on there.
If I could just ring my Colorado bell just one time to for all the people who think that the mail system's all screwed up and it's not the good way to do this. Colorado's been voting by mail for 7 years now. 98% of voters in Colorado vote by mail. The Conservative Heritage Foundation did a study of those 16 million votes and tried to find fraud, and they found 9 cases out of 16 million. Proving the point. We should have a presidential commission to look into this.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about election night, because we intimated sort of what does it look like. And I think maybe walking folks through, you know, how this thing could go and what they're going to see. I mean, we're going to start off with, you know, Georgia is going to close at 7 o'clock Eastern, North Carolina and Ohio at 7:30. Florida is got two time zones, right? The bulk of the state's going to close at 7 Eastern, the panhandle at 8. And, you know, in all of those states, all four of those states plus Ohio, well, I mentioned Ohio, in all those states, they count those early votes in the beginning, and they count them before Election Day. So you're going to see that vote moved about an hour or so after these polls close. You'll see that come up on the boards everywhere.
And that will probably show early advantage for Democrats, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're going to see probably some larger numbers.
Exactly.
Right. You'll see some larger numbers. My guess is with Florida closing, that panhandle closing at 8, let's suppose that we start to see the broader numbers around, say, 8:30, and then Florida starts to the election day turnout starts to trickle in. I got to assume that by 9:30 or 10 o'clock Eastern time, we're going to get a sense of kind of where this Florida thing is going.
Well, I think that you're going to look at counties is what you're going to do. And yeah, if you see trends where, you know, the Obama counties that voted for Trump have flipped back, for example, if you see massive numbers, you know, Broward County, apparently the turnout is just astronomical. That could be a real that could be a tell, the numbers that come in from. I mean, there will be clues. There will be Peach County in Georgia. There will be clues of places that are sort of bellwether counties that we will be able to watch. But I think it's important that people understand that when they dump the early vote in, Biden will have a lead, and that lead will be whittled away to some degree during the night. And so, you know, get a grip on your emotions, gang.
Well, and the flip side of this is, right, the three states that we've all been conditioned to think about this race through, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, with some small exceptions in Michigan, in which they can start to look at that early vote the day before the election, all three of those states are going to see that election day vote put up first. And some of that...
Just the reverse will happen.
Yeah, the early absentee vote is going to start to trickle in because legally they can't look at it. In fact, you had a county last night in Pennsylvania, Cumberland County, right outside of not far from York, Pennsylvania, sort of center of the state, and they put out a press release that said they're not counting early or mail-in absentee votes until they're not starting until 9 a.m. on Wednesday to count those votes. And so the one thing, just as people, you know, are thinking through this, if this thing doesn't, we're going to, again, have that 9:30, 10 o'clock look at sort of where we think things are going. And we may have a good sense of whether it's going to be a really late night, or we're going to have a really good sense of whether this thing is going to go a week.
Yeah.
Because Pennsylvania accepts currently ballots postmarked but not received until 3 days after. That's again up for, it's been litigated a couple times in front of the Supreme Court. Michigan Secretary of State has said it could be the weekend before they have results, could be early the next week before Pennsylvania has a good sense. You know, so there's a couple of different paths here where we may have a better sense, you know, 5 hours after the polls close in most places, and it may be 5 days.
Yeah. I am told that in Allegheny County around Pittsburgh, they have equipment that is high-speed counting equipment. They believe they're going to be able to turn these ballots around very quickly. So we may have some indication from Allegheny, which is a big county. And,
right.
And if you know, if Biden's margin is wider than Hillary's, that would be a bit of a tell.
Right.
So I think we'll have clues. We will have clues, but it would be a lot less complicated if Biden were to win Florida, then you'd know. If Trump wins Florida, it could signal, as I said earlier, this long twilight struggle.
Yes.
You didn't mention North Carolina, though, Robert, your old stomping grounds.
I definitely think North Carolina is going to be one of those places, too, that you're going to see that, again, start to come in probably... Polls close there 7:30 Eastern time. I think you'll see, again, about an hour after that, you'll see that come in. I think that could be also an early tell. Interestingly,
they also start counting. They can extend beyond, but they also count in advance of election day. So we should get a pretty good read on North
Absolutely.
Carolina.
North Carolina. And look, as we've talked about, you know, if any one of these places goes, it's likely over, right? If a North Carolina falls, particularly if a Georgia falls, you know,
yeah.
But if Florida, that kind of stuff, You know, and I think that next wave of stuff, we've got 9 o'clock Eastern, you've got Wisconsin closing, Arizona closes. I think it'll be interesting to see Arizona.
Well, that's a state that's going to have their count. They're like Florida.
Well, but remember in 2018, it took a while to get the Senate race
figured out.
Because
it was so close. I mean, if it's really, really close, then it'll be problematic. Hey, before
we run out. Are you predicting a blowout in Arizona? I just wanted to get that on the record before
You know, I spend a little time in Arizona. I'm not predicting that. But I mean, there's a difference between razor thin and.
Totally.
So we'll see. I mean, I'm going to be watching Maricopa County. Trump, that's 60% of the vote there. Trump won by 3 points 4 years ago. If Biden wins the county, I think that'll be a tell about where this whole thing might go. What are you guys hearing about the Senate before we go out? I don't want to leave that because I'll tell you something. I don't know if Biden wins the presidency but doesn't win the Senate. I would very much consider accepting the honor on election night and then resigning the day after the election and handing it to Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
Here's a breaking news item.
Ooh,
that testifies to just how difficult Republican senators are feeling and squeezed. Colorado has an incumbent Republican,
right,
Cory Gardner, running,
yes,
who just tweeted out the following, quote, "I disagree with anyone who says we're rounding the bed," Cory Gardner in a difficult race says on Fox about COVID.
Yeah.
So at the last moment, trying to get a little distance from the boss.
Yeah. It's a little late for that.
Yeah.
I think that one
too
is
late, I think too late for Cory.
As there used to be a late colorful and corrupt Secretary of State and Speaker of the House in Illinois named Paul Powell. And when they were putting a legislative deal together, at the end, he would say, "I can smell the meat a cooking." I think the meat is a cooking in Colorado on that Senate race. But the question is about others. Kelly, I think, will probably win in Arizona.
I think Teresa Greenfield's got a real shot.
Well, but it's a little more marginal in Iowa. Susan Collins is running, she's hanging in there, but they have that rank order thing where there are three candidates,
right,
and then if your candidate isn't in the final two, then they take your second choice.
That's,
and it's
right,
hard to believe that the incumbent is going to be the second choice of the third-party independent candidate. So she could lose on the strength of that second choice thing. But, North Carolina and Iowa, those races are may determine the Senate.
I think you'd have to believe today Democrats are a somewhat slight favorite, but a favorite to control the Senate. I think the challenge is once you get past the races that we mentioned, even into Iowa, the question is what happens. I don't think you add many after that, because then you're starting to get into states where you're going to have to find Trump Bullock voters in Montana. Now, I believe there can be some, and I think that one will be really close. But, do you, in a place like South Carolina, are there enough Trump Harrison voters to beat Lindsey Graham? Are there enough? And look, I think we just live in a world where there are so few split ticket voters these days.
There'll be more Trump Harrison voters, I suspect, than Trump Bullock voters. Maybe not. But I mean, Lindsey Graham, there is a history with some of these Trump voters who are still pissed that he was, before he jumped into Trump's lap, that he was, he was gnawing on Trump's ankles.
I just think the challenge for Democrats in the Senate, once you get past, again, those maybe 5 to 6 races that we talked about, is you're going to have to do what that didn't happen in any race in 2016 in the Senate, which is have a Senate candidate of a different party than the person who won the presidential vote in that state.
I agree.
And that's where I think life gets much, much, much harder.
I agree
with that. Yeah. Well, that's a problem there's that. You talk about anxiety. I think that's legitimate anxiety right now, because they don't have that big a margin. They've got a lot of opportunities, but it's not clear how many of them are real.
Yeah.
And so, Iowa, North Carolina, people can be watching those races closely on election night.
absolutely. Is it that time, Axe?
It's listener mailbag.
Mark, our question for you comes from Dean. He said, assuming Trump loses next week, what are the chances he runs again in 2024? And if he doesn't run, would he be the kingmaker and that we'll all be talking about in the Republican primary? What does the post-Trump world look like for Republicans?
Reading my mail, it's a great question. In fact, I wrote a column about this recently. I mean, first of all, to your point, I mean, if Trump may lose, but he's not going to lose that coalition. They're going to be just as wedded to him as they have been the last 4 years. And so the question is, what happens to that coalition? And my column I wrote was that, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, it'll be a Don Jr. or Ivanka or, you know, name your other Republicans, Nikki Haley, Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, to me, I think if I had to bet money, I'd bet it'd be Donald Trump coming back for revenge. I mean, he doesn't want to, he thinks he's the only, he's not going to think anybody else can handle his coalition the way he did. And that, I mean, anybody else will be sloppy seconds in his view. And he's going to be mad. And
no, he's but listen, he's going to be 78 years old. No one's going to elect a 78-year-old president.
Good point. Of course. What was I thinking?
Yeah.
I think there's a very good chance of that happening if he's not, you know, locked up somewhere.
Well, that's an issue, isn't it?
Well, it is an issue. And that's part of the reason he doesn't want to leave the presidency. He's going to have to face some legal issues. But here are my two other – this is I put in the category of the wild-ass forecasts that you make and everybody forgets because they almost never happen. But when they do, 4 years from now, people say, remember when McKinnon on this podcast said that Trump will run for re-election or the nominee will be – Tucker Carlson or Dan Crenshaw?
There you go.
Wow.
You got to wear a hat like that to make a prediction.
Yeah, man. He's got the hat and the cattle.
4 years from now, I'm going to dial that back up for you guys.
All right. Yeah, we'll keep the tape.
One of two things will be true. Either you'll be reminding us and everybody about what you said, or we'll be reminding you, Mark.
Yeah. But rest assured, we will have this conversation one way or the other.
Oh, goodness. That's a good one. All right, David.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure you didn't write this question in, but giving it to you.
But I always like to get the one from David. I always get the question from David.
So it's a tell with everybody's emailing questions. Sign them off David, and they're more likely to be picked.
And start with, I'm a big admirer.
Yeah, exactly. How freaked out should we be about the received but not returned mail-in ballots? Republicans seem to have a higher rate of sending them in. Is this just because people are tossing the mail and voting in person?
You know, it's funny you should ask that because I had a conversation with a prominent Republican today who took heart in the fact that there were 200,000 Democrats in Pennsylvania who had not yet returned their ballots, and there's a complicated procedure that they would have to go through if they want to invalidate their ballot and vote on election day. So there was a glimmer of hope on the part of the Republicans in that regard. You know, in most states, I think that if you you can go in and vote if you haven't returned your ballot. The big concern is the ballots that were sent where people think that they have voted and they're received after election day. And as we turned out, those could become the subject of litigation after because of the aggressive posture that the Republicans apparently are willing to take. I don't think this is going to be the margin of difference in the election, but especially with the volume of voting that we see. But it's a legitimate question. And one thing that this election is going to do, and the economy itself may be slow to recover, but the legal profession is going to do pretty well in the period after this election because a lot of lawyers are going to be engaged in fighting all these issues out if, in fact, the election is still up in the air after Tuesday.
We should certainly tell every listener, if you've got a mail-in ballot now, don't put it in the post office. Fill it out and take it to election headquarters if you can. Take it to a drop box. don't at this point in the election calendar, don't dump it in the mail. Unless you're in a state that you know those votes are counted postmarked, but counted post November 3rd.
So, Robert, Leo, a friend from across the pond, a devoted British hackeroo, he says,
we're
on
global.
The other side of the pond. Yes, we are. What do you recommend as the best U.S. election beer snack combo to keep me going here in the wee small hours, or at least until they call Florida?
To all our listeners, pace yourself, right? Don't open up something to start drinking at like 8 o'clock at night, because you want to be coherent by the time this thing gets around and you get to understand stuff. But look, a nice beer, some nachos, maybe a little popcorn, some finger food, so you don't like load up on stuff, because and I think I'm going to have a pretty hefty pot of coffee brewing for how long this is going to take, because I think it's going to go a while. And so my biggest thing is pace yourself, get some finger foods, and pace yourself.
You know what? I think that's complete bullshit. We have to stay alert and awake and drink caffeine and so on. My advice to you, Leo, is get several pints, and I would drink heavily and eat everything you can find. If you're going to pace, I don't know that I'd pace myself. I would pace, though. Definitely pacing helps. And McKinnon, I don't know whether you have any advice, parting advice for Leo.
We have something in Colorado, or we used to when I was growing up, called 3-2 beer, which is, of course, awful. And you, being a sophisticated beer drinker, would never drink this. But it's only 3.2% alcohol, which means you could drink it if you were younger for a time growing up in Colorado. I think you could be, 16 or something.
As a true hack, I would say, if you're going to go that route, then drink twice as much.
Well, and you can drink twice as long is the key. And so I think this could go beyond election night. So I'm with Gibbs. Pace yourself.
Yeah, a week of drinking is a little excessive. All right.
Leo's question conjures up any superstitions, anything you two did on election day or election
there's
night?
There's one thing I've always done on election day, at least when I was doing campaigns, was I would go see a movie, because I was just so wound up, and there's nothing I could do as the ad guy at that point, you know. So I need to take my mind off it. I'd just go to a dark theater and watch a couple of movies.
I mean, that's a great idea, because mostly what you do on election day is call everybody you know and say, well, what do you hear? What do you hear? What do you hear? And it's a kind of...
Big turnout in Collin County.
Exactly. My favorite is when you heard something you started three calls after you start making them, and it's just a big circle.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm looking forward to it, though. I'm looking forward to it. This is a momentous election day, and it's going to be one for the books. So.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you 4 years, and when we're talking about President Crenshaw,
you got it. We ought to schedule that right now.
A bold, bold prediction. There
All
you
right.
go.
All right, boys.
Thank you.
Kick it hard. Carry on, regardless.
Gibbs and Murphy and I will be back on Monday with our final predictions. And unlike McKinnon, we have control of the recording, and we can destroy it right after the campaign if it doesn't work out the right way. So we'll see you then.
McKinnon, thanks, and travel safe.
Kick it hard. Thanks, guys.
All right, boys.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.